You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas behind your favorite online brands. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Tom, Dan, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Tom Gerhart, Dan Provost, you're the co-founders of Studio Neat. I was trying to figure out when it was that I had you on my original podcast. There was a podcast that I did before this one called Edgemade, and you were the first guest on that one, and that was October 2013.
Woo! Wow.
So I can't believe it's been like almost 5 years.
Yeah, geez.
Well, if people don't know what you're up to, your company is called Studio Neat. People can look it up online. How do you describe Studio Neat these days?
We make things. We're a small, really small company of two people that try to make thoughtful, cool things. That's about it. Not very pitchy, but it does the trick.
That was the voice of Tom there.
That's right.
And Dan, what do you say when you're at a dinner party and you're trying to explain Studio Neat?
Yeah, basically that. I just say we make stuff. I usually start with like the Apple accessory game because I feel like that's the easiest thing for people to understand, and throw in like apps. Everyone understands what an app is. And then if they seem interested, then we can start talking about, we also make cocktail tools and stationery products and all these other things. And yeah.
Most of your products were crowdfunded. You've done 9 Kickstarter campaigns at this point, I think. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The Cosmonaut, wait, was the, no, the Glyph was the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Glyph and then Cosmonaut. Glyph was the iPhone tripod mount that was probably one of the very first physical products on Kickstarter back in the day.
Yeah, one of the, definitely the first like one that got, that blew up kind of.
Yeah. And then Cosmonaut was a stylus for, or is a stylus for touchscreens. Since then, you've gone into cocktail making tools and kits. You've worked on other like Apple accessories, like the watch dock, the phone dock, the material dock, Apple TV remote stand. And most recently, the stuff that you've been working on is the stationery products, the notebook, the Pano book, which I love, obviously. I feel like I'm going to take maximum credit for that one.
That's true.
But you, we can, you come back,
yeah,
to that.
You could take some credit for that one.
Well, we'll get to that. And then the most recent one, the most active project, which you're in the process of manufacturing at the moment, is the Mark One retractable pen. That's the big thing that you're up to right now, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
The thing that people listening to this show would enjoy is also your podcast, which is called Thoroughly Considered. It's sort of similar to Well Made, except it's more Studio Neat-y. Like, Thoroughly Considered is like the Studio Neat version of Well Made. It's just like slightly more precise somehow. What is your podcast about?
Well, our podcast is basically about Studio Neat, I guess. It started as a podcast. It was going to be about us developing a product, but then that product like failed to fund on Kickstarter. And so we're like, well, what do we do now? And so we just end up talking kind of about, you know, what we're doing, but more about, you know, running a small business and manufacturing and the technical things about that, and kind of just like whatever is going on. And we have a co-host also, Mike Hurley, who does a good job of kind of like asking us questions. And so, yeah, if you're interested at all about making anything physical or running a small design entrepreneurship type business, then it might be something, yeah, you like. Or if you just like my voice, who knows?
So I think that you do an incredible job of walking people through all of the details of each of those projects that you've worked on recently. And I think there was that first one, which was the Obi, right? That was the one, mm-hmm, that, mm-hmm, failed. That was like the pet, I guess, what do you call it? Toy?
Laser cat toy. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was a really fascinating thing. We could go into that as well, just general things that you've learned over the years making all these Kickstarter projects. But then since then, you've gone into all the details of creating the notebook and the pen. So if people want to understand what it takes to actually build a product kind of from start to finish, I think it's a really, really good thing to listen to, and you're always making new stuff.
Mm-hmm.
When I was going back in time to like the first time we talked on the first podcast, which I'll put a link to, I didn't have the guts to actually listen to it. I was too scared to listen to it because it was the first one that I've ever recorded. But maybe some other people are are more experimental want to try that out. You had done 4 Kickstarter projects, and now you're up to 9. That's like roughly 1 per year. And I think that the thing is, well, it was 2013, so I don't know. Somehow you got a lot of them in quickly, and then since then it's been like maybe a little slower pace. Mm-hmm. But I think that the thing that was not so clear at that time, if we zoom back 5 years ago, was the breadth of different directions you would end up taking. Because at that time you hadn't done anything, or maybe you had just done the neat ice kit, but you hadn't gone down all of these different paths. And this is going to sound like a criticism, but it really is actually a good thing. This entire time, you've stayed 2 people. You're basically the same roles, continuing to make products that you care about, that you enjoy, whatever things are like piquing your curiosity at any given time. You're still using the same fundamental product design process and like making products, crowdfunding them, shipping them and selling them through your website. You've made iterations on some of the products, like the Glyph has had a few different versions and maybe some of the others have too, but you haven't really discontinued anything. You've kept them all going, aside from Simple Bracket, which is an interesting one, the basketball March Madness bracket app, which we can also get to. But I just want to give people who've never heard of you guys a sense for like the very specific decisions that you've made in building your business. And it's fascinating now after like, you know, 9 years to see the breadth of what you've done and the meta level, like how you approach this. How does that make you feel?
Well, the whole business has always been like super organic for us in terms of, you know, how it's evolved or how it's grown or changed. Because the thing that we care about most basically is just like doing things we're interested in and being able to like keep doing this basically. So we're privileging the same thing and we're lucky to not have a lot of outside influences. So it kind of makes sense that have continued along the same path. But we're like very weird for a business, I think. We kind of do everything wrong in some ways, like from a business 101 perspective. Like we really move around a lot. Like you said, we've had so many different categories of products. It's kind of the wrong thing to do. Like if you really wanted to make a business that was growing, it was making lots of money and had a real trajectory, you know, you'd stick to one category and do the same thing over and over. But we like do the exact opposite of that, which makes things really hard for us in some ways, but it's also really fun.
Yeah. The thing, just thinking back to, you said that podcast was 2013.
Yeah.
The first one, kind of what's changed since then. I think for me, at least, I feel, I guess, just like more confident in our process and kind of our business model, I guess, is that I feel like in some ways we're kind of just a really good proof of like Kevin Kelly's 1,000 True Fans theory, where it's just like we don't need to have a huge smash hit. And as long as we have, you know, a handful of people that are kind of fans of our work, and we kind of share a similar, you know, design aesthetic, we can just like keep making things that we think are really cool. And that's like good enough. Like we can stay afloat by just kind of serving our audience and like, you know, slowly growing our fan base, but just like building a body of work that, like Tom said, is we're not kind of doing the smart thing and that we're kind of sticking to a product category and trying to grow it super big that way, but rather just kind of listening to our intuitions. And that seems to be surprisingly sustainable for, you know, the kind of company we have, which is, you know, just 2 people making things. So that's been kind of comforting, even though we have had setbacks and failures. Like that podcast was recorded before our biggest failure, which was that laser pet toy. But I think that was a really kind of clarifying event for us. Just like, I feel like we're on like really solid ground right now. So it feels good.
One of my questions was going to be like, how long do you want to keep going with this approach? And it sounds like you, as long as possible is the answer. But that's a very specific thing about your relationship with each other, because I think a lot of times that's something that is a tension. Like one person maybe wants to go bigger with something or pushed down deeper into a certain direction. It seems like you have a shared vision of how that works. Is that correct? Do you feel like you're both really on the same page? And how did you get there? Like, did you know that from the very beginning?
No. You know, it's funny. When we started the business, we were really living like doppelganger lives. We were living in the same apartment building, even in the same line of apartments, so I could like drop something out of my window and Dan could catch it theoretically, you know? And so we were both working as designers in New York, and we were friends. And so I think maybe that's part of the reason why, as like having a business relationship, we agree on kind of the deep fundamentals, is we both were kind of have the same background, and we, I think, have the same kind of attitude in general about life and value the same things. So I think that really helps what you're talking about. I think we both just like the work of developing products. And so that's what we focus on doing, to the detriment of the business sometimes, for sure. But we do the business side of it well enough so that we could keep making products, basically. You know, we just gave this talk in Boise at the ConvertKit conference. And so we had a chance to really kind of reevaluate just like how we talk about ourselves and like how we see the future. And I think we, like Dan said, we're both really confident and happy about where we are and how we're set up for the next like 10 or 20 years in terms of a business, because we just think that the way that we approach making products, which is basically outsourcing as much as we can, like we work from home and all of our manufacturing is done out of house, and we, all the fulfillment and everything is kind of outsourced besides the design work. And it's just going to get easier and easier to do that stuff. And so we feel like we're in a really good position for the future. And so that feels good. Like, it feels like we have somehow wandered into making the right decisions, which was totally not intentional, but I think we kind of lucked into that. So it feels like we can keep doing this as long as we, you know, can keep our wits about us and make, you know, products that are good, basically.
Yeah. And one of the things I think that personally has been one of the biggest challenges and frustrations, but also the joy of it in my life as a like creative person, is I have the tendency to like trying a lot of different things. I feel more like a generalist than a specialist. And there's this internal monologue that I've had my whole life and I can't get rid of it, which is like, what if instead of doing 10,000 different things, yeah, I just like did, yeah, one thing. and it's like, how would my life be different if instead of, because I like the photography and the copywriting and, you know, programming and all these different things. They're all just different avenues for creativity and they're really fun. At the moment, I'm pretty focused on applying those to a specific problem. In your case, you both are doing all of those things and across a lot of different categories. I think that's probably just a lot of fun. I like that aspect.
It is fun, but I mean, I am totally often jealous about like, man, maybe I should just become like a knife maker and just make knives the rest of my life. But Dan, do you ever have that tendency?
To want to specialize?
Yeah, just like straight up, like I'm going to be a blank, just like only do this one thing.
I don't know. I think that's like really essential for our business, and something we're really lucky is that kind of because of our background and our education, we are generalists. So we are able to do almost everything that needs to be done. So we can take the photographs and we can make the videos and do, you know, all of the engineering drawings and such and the website and all this. And so that's been like really great, is just because of kind of our backgrounds, where we came from. Like, it's been not easy, is not the right word, but it's like felt possible because it's like, oh yeah, we know how to do like all these things that are necessary to like sell things on the internet. So that's been nice.
Well, that's our skill. Like, we always are feeling like we are doing something brand new that we don't know how to do. And that's why it takes us forever to develop products. So for instance, this pin that we are in manufacturing right now, before the Kickstarter, it was an entire year. We were designing that pin for an entire year. And if, wow, you look at the pin, it's like, this is the most minimal, boring pin in the world. Like, what are you talking about? Why did this take you guys a year? And right, it's because we designed our own custom click mechanism. We went through all this stuff. We had to do all this learning to then arrive at a pin. Whereas if we were like making pins all day, it'd be like no brainer.
This might not be, again, because we're like bad at business, I might be like looking at this the wrong way, but I feel a certain comfort in the diversification of our product line, where if we were like just a pen maker or just a bag maker, like, I mean, that would be fine, obviously. Like, there's companies that exist that do that. But I think I would always have this little bit of like nervousness. It's like, oh, what if we like tomorrow are like disrupted by, you know, like the Casper of bags or whatever. Whereas we have like so many things where if Apple made like a tripod mount tomorrow that was like way better than the Glyph and cheaper, that would really stink, but it wouldn't sink our business. It would just sink that product, potentially. And so that might not be like an actually real thing to be worried about, but it's something I do kind of like, is there's a certain comfort in that we've kind of like have our hand in all these different pies that we're kind of spread out in a good way, I think.
So you mentioned the Kevin Kelly 1,000 True Fans. By the way, he was on this podcast.
Yeah, I listened to that one.
Go back and listen to that one. We'll link back to that. But do you feel like you have that group of fans that are cutting across all of the different products? They are the ones, or are you developing new fan bases or new groups of people in your audience who particularly care about one or the other, or is it a snowball? What's the analogy here?
Like, we are so bad at business that we don't know the answer to that question. No, I mean, we have a feeling that, yeah, we definitely have a lot of repeat customers and people who just like, you know, we hear from people, oh, we'll like back it automatically, you know, or whatever. So there's absolutely like, I think, a pretty deep recurring customer thing, but we don't actually know like the numbers about, you know, how that breaks down exactly. But I think we really like to think of ourselves as like a band. We're not a company, we're a band. We keep making albums and we just want to keep getting fans.
That's a really good analogy.
That's why we really don't like hard selling stuff, because we only want a customer to have something if it's actually like right for them. So we feel weird when we're like have to really give a hard sell on something, because if it's not for the person, we would rather them not have it, because we would really only want customers that are like really happy.
I like that analogy of the band. And in a way, Jesse and I have kind of done that with Lumi, but at each like major stage of Lumi, we've tossed the old version behind and just sort of like burned it and like started over. Whereas you've kept all of these things, and I'm just, that part is really fascinating to me, that the aspect of keeping even your first products around and having that body of work. I'm just wondering, with the way that you've described the business, is it a lot of work to maintain and continue to sell those? Because it seems like it would be hard to get back up to the minimum order quantities for some of those old products once they've been around for a little while.
Yeah, sometimes. And I mean, we have retired a couple products and like older versions of the Glyph and stuff. But yeah, for the most part, we kind of just keep selling stuff. And again, this might be like being bad at business, but we're a little bit more comfortable with like having inventory that we just let ride for, you know, a year or whatever. So instead of kind of ordering new inventory every quarter or something, we might kind of like order enough for a year and just kind of let it be in a warehouse and slowly trickle out over time. So in that regard, that's how we kind of get around the minimum order quantity issue, is we just like buy a year's worth of inventory.
I'm really sensing the theme now of you guys being bad at business.
Well, see, the thing is we're just privileging simplicity. The basically the thing is we want to think about inventory like four times a year. And so we just do that because it's the easy thing to do and we don't want to think about it again. So it's not like we understand that that's not good. And there's like cash flow issues and stuff that happen from that. But I mean, we just don't want to think about it. And it's a total pain to like, you know, order all that stuff. So whenever we say we're bad at business, we're basically just, we just optimize for simplicity always. And sometimes that means we ignore a lot of stuff, which we know we shouldn't be ignoring.
And just to like further give a detail to your question, like, so for example, for this pen, that we're in the middle of producing and we have, you know, Kickstarter orders to fulfill. I think we have about 4,000 backers, or a little shy of 4,000. And so generally when we do an order, we'll order kind of like twice as much. So we're kind of getting quotes for, you know, packaging and parts and stuff for that quantity, you know, 8,000 or 10,000 or whatever. But we're also getting quotes for much lower quantity because we know, like, the next time we reorder, it's not going to be that big. So we do have that in mind and kind of make sure the prices are making sense at a high quantity and a lower quantity so that we don't just get totally bitten down the line when we have to reorder. So we are trying to do somewhat of a good job of that. But yeah, it is. We do optimize for simplicity, like Tom said.
Maybe you don't have any data on this, but do you have a sense of, I'm guessing when you do one of your new Kickstarters, that's when you're getting a certain amount of promotion going around the company and you're gathering, you know, a few new people who might be excited about that new thing. So with the pen, for instance, you get a new audience of people who are interested in the pen. Are you able to see then that they're going back into your catalog, into the older archive of your old albums?
In a couple ways, yeah. So recently we've been using this thing called BackerKit to help kind of collect surveys and do some of the fulfillment back end stuff for a Kickstarter campaign. And one of the things they do is they like upsell the backers basically on other products we have. So we just say, hey, you got this, but you can also buy this. And quite a few people add on stuff. So that's like nice for one. But the other thing that kind of, I think, really makes us value Kickstarter and like those big launches is the conversion rate to our email list is like huge from a Kickstarter campaign. We might get like 80, 90% of the backers that get on our list. And so that, you know, in our lists, like kind of conversion rate and open rate has kind of stayed the same, our email list. And so, you know, to us that says we're not tracking people like all the way through the funnel, although we probably could do that. I've been meaning to try to make some script that kind of figures that out. But in general, it does definitely feel like after these big Kickstarter campaigns, we're getting like customers that will come back, or fans that will, or we're kind of like starting a relationship. And so that feels really good. And that's really been the biggest way that we grew our email list, is through these big chunks that come in after Kickstarter campaigns. So yeah, it's kind of wacky, but it does feel like it's working.
So right now you're primarily selling through your website and through Amazon. Those are the two main places, right?
Yep.
And do you see the other way around, where there's like a long tail of people who are, I don't know, just searching for cocktail stuff on Amazon and then they find you? Are they able to navigate back to your to the rest of your stuff, or are those Amazon people just completely separate?
So tricky. I think our Amazon searching rank is so low on almost everything but the Glyph that anyone who's going to Amazon is going there not browsing. They're like going there and searching for the product because they want to buy it on Amazon. It would be my guess. We have no way to know if someone buys something on Amazon, like if they come back to us. There's no way we can correlate that or track it. But my guess is that, yeah, people aren't browsing. But there are a lot of like websites or blogs that will like review one of our products and they'll link to Amazon. So that might kind of, they never go through our website. So that could be kind of lost. So that is definitely a downside of Amazon for sure. But I think the conversion rate is so much higher on Amazon that it, for us, it just like feels right to have our products on there. And about like half of our revenue comes from Amazon. So,
yeah, I mean, I think people are pretty used to just the Prime shipping and all that stuff. And even if they know about your website, they might go there anyway, just because it's convenient.
I do that all the time. I mean, that's what I do for almost anything else. So, yeah.
And so when you're thinking about creating a new product, do you have a laundry list of stuff out there that you're thinking, you know, themes or categories that you've always wanted to get into, or things that your fans, your people in this audience are asking for? Or is it always just like whatever is the thing of the moment that you're suddenly getting obsessed by?
It's both. I mean, we definitely have a list of like products that we're interested in working on. And we try to kind of, our ideal kind of working situation is having kind of a staggered approach to product development, to where, you know, when we're in the production phase of one product, we're like prototyping another product and we're like coming up with ideas and sketching like a third product. So we're kind of like in the different phases simultaneously. And we're kind of doing that right now with a few products. And so we do have kind of a short-term kind of path for what our next few products will be, but it's always in flux and new things can pop up all the time that we like immediately prioritize because we're really excited about it. And some products take kind of a much longer time for the like iteration and testing phase. So that will kind of like change scheduling in two. So it's a little bit of both.
How do you commit to doing something? You mentioned the pen, you know, you've been working on it for a year. At what point in that year were you like, okay, we're really doing it for real?
Well, we have these like set of submarine keys. And so, you know, we'll just quietly both turn them. If it is kind of like that, it is kind of like launching a ballistic missile. there's a kind of a first, like a low pass filter or high pass filter. I don't know which one of, you know, Dan and I will like shoot back ideas like, oh, maybe we should do this. And usually one of us just like isn't interested. And so we usually don't try to like hard sell each other. And we're just like, okay. But if we both kind of think it might work, have done some sketching and just some ideas about like what the product story is or like what the product insight is, if we both think that kind of works, then we'll kind of move it into like maybe some 3D modeling, some kind of figuring out materials or how it would be made, like feasibility kind of testing. And then at that point, if it seems like it's feasible and we both are still like into it and we think it would work, then yeah, it usually keeps going. And usually at that point, we almost everything will do it. I don't think there's been very many products where we get pretty far into them and then we decide to stop. Sometimes they completely change, but usually they don't stop.
How much of it is related to materials or manufacturing processes or things that you are interested in exploring that's not necessarily the product, so to speak, but the way it's made?
Oh, almost never, I would say, right, Dan?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, a lot of times we'll kind of have product ideas, just like the kernel of an idea. And then it's just like, well, this would be like really difficult to execute, you know, like we don't know how to manufacture this, or it'd be really hard, or we can't figure out a way to make it easier or cheaper. And so we'll just kind of like go on the back burner or go away. But yeah, we usually don't let kind of like new manufacturing processes like scare us away from an idea. And then on the flip side, we're generally not like, ooh, we really want to like try this manufacturing style. Let's, you know, like come up with a product that can do that. Like, I mean, we never do that.
So one example of like how a product kind of like happens, I think, is, like 2 years ago now or something, we thought maybe we should make a notebook. Like we were just kind of toying with that idea. Like, you know, if we made a notebook, what would it be? Blah, 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 blah. And we talked to you, I think, pretty early on. And you're like, I like these like long, like panoramic notebooks. And we were like, oh, yeah, that's kind of cool. We had a couple ideas. Then we were going to make like a traveler, like a really thin, like bendy kind of moleskinish notebook. But nothing was really sticking, and we were just like, man, okay, like, yeah, we could do that, but it doesn't really seem right. But then Dan had this insight of, you know, it would be really awesome if I had a notebook that fit in between me and my keyboard when I'm working at my desk. And that was like literally it. Like, that's it. Like, you still remember the sketch he sent, and like, where it's like, oh, okay, no, that's what the product is. Like, that's the product story. And whenever that happens, that's when I think we both really know that it's the right thing. Like we kind of, like right now we're thinking about making another notebook right now, but it just doesn't feel right. Like we have some ideas, but it just doesn't feel right. And I think we're both kind of waiting around until the right thing happens and it kind of snaps into focus. And usually what that means is like the product story, like what is this thing at its base level, like in like one little phrase and like a tagline, what is this thing? And if that comes into clear focus, then usually we're kind of on board and we'll figure out a way to make it happen. So that's kind of always what we're waiting around for usually with a product. And it never feels good when we don't kind of have that thing.
Yeah, my standard notebook, I can see this giant stack that I probably have like 30 of them from the past 10 years, is this... I think it's 8x5 or something, or 8.5x5. It's like super, super panoramic, even more so than, and it's like shorter than the one that you guys made. And I had never thought about the fact that maybe one of the reasons I like it is that it fits that way. It's interesting that you had the insight like separately, and I never thought about that fact. For me, it's just I really like that format, and it's weird, and people are always like, what is this notebook? But it's just kind of a cool format. I like the ability to segment the page in a lot of different ways, like, you know, divide it into thirds, divide it into quarters, half. You've done a really nice job as well with the paper. The one that I have, which by the way was discontinued, but I bought a whole bunch of them, so I'm gonna have to switch to yours soon. Mine has blank paper, but yours has these cool dots, and you have these sort of secret patterns hidden in there if you know where to look. A lot of clever stuff about that notebook. But another thing that I remembered about the product development about that one was this was the first product, I think, that had the ability for someone to want to purchase more than one. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, it had that inherent idea that someone, you know, might need a few of these, or if they really enjoy it, would purchase it again. Was that an idea that came before the idea of the notebook, or did it just make sense together?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't know the exact order. I remember always just being really jealous of Field Notes as a company. Aside from the fact that they make a really good product and they're just like really good at design and stuff, it was like, man, it is so nice that people use up notebooks and then have to buy another one. Like it's so, like what you just said, it's so nice to have basically a consumable product where you can have a number of fans, and as long as they keep filling up their notebooks and buying new ones, like you have a business. And so I don't remember if that's what instigated us wanting to make a notebook, but it was definitely a thought of like, oh, this will be nice and, you know, something new for us. None of our other products really fit that bill. So we were definitely pumped about that aspect of it.
And has it panned out well since then?
I guess it's hard.
Are you seeing that behavior?
We haven't really tracked it. I think. I mean,
maybe it's too early.
It's hard to know like what the life cycle of that is. But I mean, I mean, people like it. So if people like it, obviously, you know, they'd probably buy it again. So, but yeah, we don't have the data. We're not very data driven. We're heart driven, you know.
Are there themes that in categories that you would share that you've always wanted to experiment with?
I'll share an absurd idea that I'm still bitter to this day. We never made it, but I think I had recently gotten like a Muji book, like I forget the gentleman's name who's like the
Fukasawa maybe. Muji.
Yeah, and he has like that white design book, and I was like admiring, you know, the like classic like wall mounted CD player,
right?
And I was like, man, what if we made like a wall-mounted record player? And I had all these ideas of like how the stylus that connects to the record could be like on this track, and it like it slides vertically like as the record is spinning. Like, it could be a really cool thing, but it was like a ridiculous idea, and so many questions about, you know, power cords dangling, and, you know, it's
right.
Like, we didn't get any farther than just like me saying what I just said out loud.
But then someone made something like that.
Yes. And then like a couple months later, there's a huge Kickstarter project. It wasn't a wall mounted record player, but it was like
a
stand-up one. It was like this huge success. Like, it raised over $1 million or something. I was just like, oh man, like that could have been us. But it actually would have been more crushing because
they would have beat us. Yeah.
We would have been like deep in development, and then they would have like beat us to it. So it wasn't to be. But that's kind of one of the more like outlandish ideas that we've had, probably.
I think in general, I'm always kind of interested in doing something more high end. Only for the reason is that we don't have to make compromise decisions. It just feels like easy, like, oh, like, let's just make this nicest materials and the nicest finish and like all this stuff. We don't have to like always worry about, you know, how much things cost. But then whenever ideas come up or we think about them more, we're always just like, we don't want to make this really expensive thing. But that's always something that's kind of tickling me, is something that is just like, you know, we can really go like heavy on the quality basically, and like heavy on, you know, making things feel nice. But I think it is kind of a silly indulgence, and so we decide usually we don't do it, but that's always tempting.
With the apps, I've noticed that you always tend to have an app that is somewhat of a companion to categories that are similar. So you've got a couple camera-related apps that work well with the Glyph, and then you have Highball, which I still use for cocktails. Is there something like that coming for stationery? Do you have a stationery app idea?
No, we don't. And the problem, we have so many app ideas. That is one place where we have a lot of app ideas. And if we let ourselves, we'd have even more. But it's just hard from a business point of view to invest a lot of time in them just because they don't make a lot of money per se. And the way we approach software is, it's kind of like a luxury good where we can be as fussy as possible with them. And so it just takes a lot of time to do apps. We actually make really good apps. But if we, like we do, like we make a really good apps. But yeah, it's one of those things where it's really hard for us to convince ourselves that that's like a good idea. Like, so we have like tons of ideas kind of like clogging our brains.
It's become harder and harder, I think, to make apps these days. And every app idea has already been done at this yes. point, I think.
But, you know, we could do cool stuff like, you know, Slow Fast Slow, which is this like app that lets you like control the speed of like a slow-mo video. And then, like you mentioned, Highball, they actually do really well in terms of download numbers. Like, Slow Fast Slow has over 1 million downloads, but they're free. And so
they never really made much money. So the thing we've been trying recently is by making them free as more or less kind of advertisements for Studio Neat. So we put some, you know, some like information about us, and people can like buy our products directly in the app, like through our mobile website and stuff. And I think that's been pretty good, but, you know, probably not good enough to justify the existence of those apps, but we try.
So apps is kind of off the table, it sounds like, as future stuff.
No, I don't think it's off the table. We might foolishly just like, we might actually foolishly try to actually make money at an app.
It would be a really bad business idea.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, things have changed a little bit. Things have changed a little bit in the App Store. But yeah, I don't think we would let it go because we're like good. That's really what Dan and I should be doing. Like if, like professionally, that's really where our skill set is.
Yeah, it's what we were doing before starting Studio Neat.
Yeah, I don't know. I think if we had a good excuse, we'll make another app, I'm sure. It's fun. It's real fun. And it's a really good balance between physical products. They're kind of like opposite. So like physical products, it's really fun because you get to like interact with the like gears of industry and you visit factories and you have all these constraints, but you're making real stuff and it's really cool and fun. But like it's really hard and really frustrating and you almost have no control because you have to rely on manufacturers for almost everything. Whereas with software, you basically have like no limit. You could do it. We have complete control over what we're doing, basically. And so we get to have that control. The problem is it's not, the business side isn't as fun, and it can get kind of grueling at the, like, you know, after 30% of the app is done, you've done all the fun stuff, then it gets really like grueling. But so it's this really nice balance in between software and hardware. And so we really like doing that. And I think if we had another big successful Kickstarter product and we've really felt like we're on some firm ground financially with the business, we would probably be, the first thing we would do is make an app. I mean, it's like the first thing we would do, I think.
I'm excited. I think it would be cool for you to continue doing both. I always enjoy that intersection between the physical and digital stuff. In our previous business with IncoDie, we were making this art supply, and for no reason we made an app because it was just fun. And I think it was similar. It got us publicity. It got us into retail stores. It helped in a way that was very hard to measure.
Yeah.
And now today we have, you know, what I do most of the time is making software. And the thing that we do is try to make it really, really easy for people to press a button and then stuff happens in the real world. And the funny thing about that is sometimes we struggle with helping people understand the complexity of what happens. You know, from doing all the stuff that you do, that, you know, when you order materials or you order parts and stuff like that, that's, even at the scale that you're doing it, pallets have to go onto freight trucks and all this different stuff has to happen. We're at the point now on the Lumi website where someone can click a button and we get orders for a million boxes at a time. And that means like 70 entire truckloads have to be packed. And like the whole manufacturing process has to happen around that. And it's so crazy that someone can just press a button and that happens. And then the problem that I remember having when I first ordered packaging and suddenly like three pallets came to our loft and we're like, oh no, what are we going to do with these pallets? Happens at that scale too. Like we're delivering, you know, an order for like 500 pallets and someone's like, oh, I didn't realize it was going to be 500 pallets. I guess I need some storage for that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And it happens at every scale. That's just something where the software versus the physical world have these such different constraints. It's just a lot of fun to be able to marry the two together.
Yeah, yeah. It's really kind of magical. I mean, in some ways, that's kind of how our business is. Because Dan and I both work from home, when this stuff gets made, A, we're like making computer drawings and stuff, and then we send them drawings, and then this stuff gets like made by machines on all over the world. But then at some point, yeah, those pallets have to go somewhere, but we have warehouses that aren't at our house, right? There's like one in the UK and one in California. And so we often don't even see the physical product. Like we don't see them at all. And so we do. It's pretty easy to live in this kind of like digital, like we have a digital interface basically with all of our physical products. And so it's pretty easy for like that to feel abstracted in a way. So yeah, that's part of the reason why I think some of our products stay around is because our relationship with them is very like arm's length. And so we don't ever see like inventory piling up or like some of that stuff because it's kind of always abstracted away. And so that's kind of weird, but it's kind of like what you're talking about where, yeah, I don't know, like, when we order a bunch of foam that's going to go in our packaging, like, I don't know how big that is. It's probably, like, huge trucks full of empty foam. It's like foam. It's just foam, you know? So it is weird. That abstraction is very odd.
But it allows you to do what you're doing without Shopify and Kickstarter and Shipwire. You know, I don't know if you're still using them, but, like, the fulfillment aspect of what you're doing. I think it would have been really hard to do the kind of business, especially at the scale of two people, 20 years ago even, or 15 years ago.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the cool thing is it's just going to get easier. I mean, like, you know, I think all like the logistics is pretty down pat. E-commerce websites are like really down. The thing that I think that can get a lot easier is small run production and manufacturing. And, you know, the next 10 or so years, it's going to get easier and easier for that stuff to happen. And so we'll have more options for the kind of machines and the kind of right. things we make. And so that's like super exciting that, you know, we can sit here in our home offices and like make kind of whatever we want. And it's just going to get easier.
Well, you're literally making parts for some of the production parts in your garage, right?
Yeah, that
like 3D printing some of that stuff.
So very few. Yeah. Like we've done that a couple times and we'll do like minor things. We've started to do more in-house assembly recently because we don't have a manufacturer that can do the assembly on some of the things. Like for these pins, we're going to be doing kind of the final assembly here. So we've stepped into doing some more of that stuff, but in general, we outsource it. So for a while, we made this little like a piece of walnut that's a little remote stand for the Apple TV remote. The first couple thousand we made of those, yeah, we did. Like, made them in my garage. But now we have someone else do it that's in Austin. So, we it's not fun to kind of do that. And that's not really where our value is. But sometimes we kind of need to do that. And I think we're excited about the possibility of kind of bringing some more of that in-house sometimes using robots, that kind of stuff. But in general, it feels really good when we can have it set up cleanly and, you know, someone else can do the manufacturing and the assembly and then ship it straight to the warehouse. Like, that feels the best. Like, that's awesome. That feels like really like we're doing it right.
I had a million questions about Kickstarter that I could ask you, but I think I'll send people to the podcast. You guys should, because you talk about it a lot there. I guess the more meta question about it is, how do you feel about it as a platform today after all these years? What's changed? Is it easier? You've never experimented with trying Indiegogo or building your own, you know, micro crowdfunding platform thing. Do you see it as a healthy place still to kickstart a project, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, it feels really good to me. It seems just really solid. I feel like there was a bit of a wave there at first where it was, you know, Kickstarter, this new thing, and it was really exciting. And then, of course, there was, you know, the inevitable backlash that seems to happen to everything that is exciting. But I feel like it's totally stabilized, more or less. And now it's just like, it's like the App Store or something. It's just like a thing that exists that we're all familiar with. And it's kind of like an accepted way to launch products. So yeah, I mean, I see us continuing to use it until it stops working, but so far it's been a really great platform for us.
Yeah, and you know, we just gave this talk and we kind of realized that really raising money is kind of like the third, it's like not even the top reason that we use Kickstarter. So like one of the like main reasons we use Kickstarter is for idea validation, basically, like product validation. So, you know, it's great because we can, you know, kind of go through the design steps, get it all set up, you know, make the pitch video and everything. And if people respond to it, then we know it's going to work out. But yeah, if it bombs and fails on Kickstarter, what that means is we just saved like ourselves tons of time and effort and money. So, for instance, with Obi, the like laser cat toy we've been mentioning that failed, it sucks because we spent like 7 months working on that thing and we made something we thought was pretty cool. But when we launched it on Kickstarter, it did okay, but it didn't really get the traction it needed to get. And that sucks. That was like no fun. But it was way better than us not using Kickstarter, using like $100,000 of our own money to make the thing and then it not getting the traction, right? And so validating ideas is like one of the main reasons why we use Kickstarter. And it's like such an awesome situation because we kind of get to, you know, sell and make this thing before it really exists. And like a lot of that risk goes away. So it's really awesome. You also get to like practice pitching it and storytelling. So it's really, I don't know, it just makes a lot of sense for us. We don't really see why you wouldn't use it.
Both of what you said makes a lot of sense to me. The fact that OB failed, for example, is actually like a really good proof point for, it's actually nice to have one that didn't work as a example, because it's,
yeah,
otherwise you're yeah, sort of doing it and you're like, why? It's a miracle that they all worked, it seems like. Yeah. But then the other thing that that Dan, you were saying, the comparison to the App Store makes a lot of sense to me, and I had never thought about it that way, because in my mind, Kickstarter still feels like a new thing. I haven't completely, I don't know, it seems like people for the most part now come to Kickstarter and sort of know how it works. In the early days, you and some of the stuff that we did, me and Jesse and, you know, lots of other people were pioneering how to even explain a product on Kickstarter. That there was like a whole phase for a few years where just the concept of you're going to put money and then, you know, that is not going to transfer right away. And then
you had to explain Kickstarter in your video, like, yeah, to people.
That was a solid 3-4 years where that, yeah, was going on. And now it's well established and it exists. And it's interesting that you bring it up as something that's relatively stable. So that makes sense. As we wrap up, I wanted to ask you one last question. It's something that has come up a few times in the conversation. You've mentioned jealousy as a motivator or as a source of inspiration. I think that I never really think about it that way, but I feel that way too. I look at products or companies or business models and I feel, oh man, I wish we could do something like that. Or maybe it's a grass is always greener feeling, like there's always a thing that seems easier about somebody else's business or a type of product that seems really interesting. You've mentioned a few. You mentioned Muji. You mentioned companies that have a product like Field Notes that you can sell over and over. Are there other things like that that inspire you and give you that feeling of, man, I wish we were doing that?
Well, I remember just early on how, like, literally when Studio Neat was starting, how important a 37 Signals book rework was for us. And just, or for me at least, and having just a really kind of fresh perspective. Like, I had never quite understood, you know, I didn't know anything about business. I guess I still don't to some degree, but I didn't realize that you were like allowed to have a business that way. And so I think that book was just hugely influential in how I think about like what we're quote unquote allowed to do and what kind of company we can have. And I think that's really been kind of like a guiding light in just terms of like privileging simplicity and like it's okay not to grow, like you can stay small on purpose and all these ideas like that we're still kind of adhering to. I was probably first exposed to those ideas in that book. So I would say, now Basecamp, they were called 37 Signals, was a hugely kind of influential company. It's funny, I'd mentioned Field Notes. I would say Cards Against Humanity is another kind of company that I see do like a really nice things in interesting ways. And those three companies are all Chicago companies. So that makes me wonder like what kind of what the common thread there is, like what culturally like kind of links those companies together. So I don't know. It's interesting.
Hustling, humble hustling, I feel like is why Chicago's awesome. I agree with Dan on all those. And the thing I find myself like being really interested and inspired and like maybe jealous about now is how companies are like structured basically, or like their approach. So, you know, part of me is always really wanting to sometimes do everything in house and like have a bunch of equipment and robots that kind of make everything. So there's some companies that are doing stuff like that, or just like I mentioned with like sticking to a product category and kind of how that restructures your design process and your supply chain and stuff like that. So that's kind of what I end up kind of really being into rather than like straight up products. However, you know, going on Pinterest and just like looking at things, you know, there's always things that are just like, ooh, that's so like so nice. And I think probably like 99.99% of the time, they're always like design student things that aren't real. Like it's like not a real thing, but it just like looks so nice. So that's kind of my two like axes of like, oh, just like straight up like visual candy, or like really, you know, just kind of nerdy. Like, how is this business structured? I like if I had a superpower, like literally, I think one of my top picks for a superpower would be to know exactly like get the balance sheet for a business, like any business, because like even the corner bodega, like how is that thing open? Like, what are their margins? Like, I'm really curious, like. Like just in general, like how does this business work? Like what are your margins? Like all that stuff. So those structural differences in businesses and the decisions they've made are really interesting to me. Like Grove Made, one of our friend businesses, I guess, Grove Made is like the opposite of us in some ways in terms of the way they structure everything. Like they try to make everything in-house and they have this big staff and to do that, to assemble everything. And so those differences are what really kind of interest and inspire me at this point.
Grove Made also, episode 32. Yeah. I was looking it up. If you want, that was a great episode. People really liked that one.
Yeah,
it's interesting that I think jealousy is a weird way to phrase it, but I think it's important to connect with that feeling that you have because it's a little more than inspiration.
Yeah,
it's a little more than that thing looks cool. It's like I wish I was running that business, or I wish I was making that product. And that tells you something about yourself that is really important.
Yeah.
For me, I think Kickstarter itself was a thing like that, where I remember just really loving the fact that they were making a platform that other people could use, like the empowering lots of other businesses. I always really enjoyed Kickstarter, Stripe, Shopify. They had so much leverage in the world because they're not making a thing. They're making a thing that helps people make things. And that seems cool. And that was probably one of the biggest inspirations for me and Jesse really radically changing the business to what it is today. So if people want to listen to your podcast, Thoroughly Considered, that's on the Relay.fm network. You can search for it in your podcast app if you're listening to a podcast currently, presumably. Figure it out.
Your podcatcher.
I think people will really enjoy it. If they enjoyed this conversation, if they made it all the way through, they're definitely going to enjoy it. And it's a lot of similar themes, but it goes into a lot of detail on every single product that you make. And then you've also got your newsletter. How do people subscribe to that?
Yeah, if you just go to studioneet.com slash gazette, G-A-Z-E-T-T-E. Basically, Dan and I have this... Dan, it's been almost 3 years. Like, this week, I think, is 3 years. We haven't ever missed a week, but we send an email on Friday. Each one of us makes a pick of something that we like on the internet. And it's usually... It's not related to our business. It's just like something we like. So we each post a link in a little paragraph and then one image of something that's going on with Studio Neat, sometimes kind of behind the scenes. So it's really simple, but people seem to like it. And so if you just want to keep up with what we're doing, that's a really fun, simple way to do it. And you get some behind the scenes stuff. And yeah, it's pretty cool.
Instagram, Twitter. I don't know.
Yeah, we got an Instagram. Yeah. Studio Neat. You know, if you just search Studio Neat, we're kind of, that's, you know, however your flavor, we're there.
Cool. Well, thank you. This is great.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, if you got something useful out of it, I would love to hear what that was. Consider writing a short review, could be just a sentence long, by going to iTunes and searching for Well Made. I want to hear it all. I want to hear good, bad. I want to hear your constructive criticisms. I am just trying to make this show as useful as possible for you. So tell us what you think. That is the very best way that you can support the show. Thanks, and see you next time.